Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Monica Liel welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckerts. Today is Friday, June 1st, 2012. Carla L. Ruckerts is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Please visit the LL Research websites, llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And bringforth.org, that's bring, the number 4, th.org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I'll be asking questions that come from you. I'll be asking these questions to Carla, and if you'd like to ask a question live on the air, call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted if you would like to join the show live. That's 646-595-2294. If you'd rather just listen in, just don't hit the 1 key, and you can do that too. When submitting questions, please remember this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Liel, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert of LL Research. Hi, Carla. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm fine. My husband's on the line, too. Jim?
Hey, oh, I'm here.
Hey, we got Jim again. Oh, that's awesome.
We do.
I'm really glad to hear that. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm doing very well.
We had a great occasion this week. It was our 25th anniversary on the 30th.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're hoping to have another 25.
Yeah, that's quite an accomplishment these days.
Not in Hollywood.
Did you do anything? Yeah. Did you do anything special?
Well, of course, I'm in and tied to a 4-foot cord. So we couldn't go out, but he went quite a ways out of his way to a beautifully expensive and lovely restaurant where they offered me prime rib and potatoes that were out of this world and dreamy dessert and flowers. I'm looking at the biggest bouquet I ever saw. And it was just lovely. You know, he did a lot more for me than I did for him.
Guys are supposed to do that.
Uh-huh. Well, so I hear. and Jim actually did. But at any rate, it was just heavenly. And I can't tell you how moved I was by the thought of how it's mounded up. And you just don't realize how the time passes. It doesn't feel like 25, well, actually 30 years, but, you know, counting all the time that Jim was a research partner, but we were not married and not romantic. You know, but we worked together and we pulled together for love and light in this world. And I really, no matter how hard I think about it, I can't grasp the fact that time has passed. You know, it's just amazing how the time just flows away. So we're hoping for another 25 to happen just like that.
Aw, that's beautiful. Well, I can totally relate because we've got 29 years, my husband and I, and it just blows my mind. It's like, that much we've been together that long? That's just, I can't wrap my brain around it.
You think you'd run out of things to talk about, but we don't. We just chatter ourselves silly.
No, it's wonderful. It gets better. I mean, it just gets deeper, and I think it's wonderful. Well, I'm glad to hear you did have a nice time, and you did do something special. There's ways to do something special without necessarily leaving the house.
That's right. That's right, and we found most of them, I think. Very
oh, that's great. Well, that's really nice. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I'm going to go ahead and go to our opening riff for tonight then. And this is from session 53.12. Questioner, I have become aware of a very large variation in the contact with individuals. Could you give me general examples of the methods used by the Confederation to awaken or partially awaken the wanderers they contact? I am Ra. The methods used to awaken wanderers are varied. The center of each approach is the entrance into the conscious and subconscious in such a way as to avoid causing fear and to maximize the potential for an understandable subjective experience which has meaning for the entity. Many such occur in sleep, others in the midst of many activities during the waking hours. The approach is flexible and does not necessarily include the close encounter syndrome, as you are aware.
Thanks, Monica. I picked this out, folks, because it seems to me that a lot of people discount their own experiences. Did they discount a dream that they might have had, or a synchronicity they might have had, or just a brief vision, something that is out of the ordinary and that makes them suddenly aware of who they might be, who they in fact are. And I'm encouraging everybody to listen to yourself, to listen to your dreams, to listen to the things that happen to you, even in the course of a busy day, because the Creator is everywhere. The Creator cannot be run from or hidden from. Yet, at the same time, we, by keeping ourselves busy and occupied with chores and projects, can actually block that beautiful presence. And I want to encourage you all to take time to maybe write down some of your dreams. Start a dream journal. Or at least, you know, give yourself the respect that you have when you have something unusual happen to you. Jim's experience is a good example. Jim, do you want to talk about Angelica?
Okay. About 1974, when I was ready to move on to my land in rural Kentucky and begin building a cabin in which I would live for there a few years, I was in a tent, and that was my camping situation at the time. And at that time, I had a friend with me there whose dog was eating dog food in a plastic bowl in the night. And it was just noisy enough to begin to awaken me, but not all the way. It got me to that kind of hypnagogic state, the preconscious state, where you're aware of where you are, and yet you're aware that there's some other kind of contact going on. And I got this little message, and it was a simple message. It said, "The key to your survival comes indirect through nervousness." And then I said, "What?" And then it said, "Angelica." And that was the name given for the source of the information. And that was a kind of a puzzle to me, but I thought about that for quite a while. And I think the reason that that message was given was I was consciously and subconsciously aware of the great amount of work that was ahead of me in order to simply be able to live there and survive there, to be able to make a home and raise my own food and do everything I was going to do. And it was kind of daunting to think about all of that. And so I guess I must have been giving out kind of a call for help, for some inspiration, and that's what came through. And it was very brief, but very vivid, and it has remained with me to this day as a piece of information, because I think that it still holds true, even though I'm not living on the land and trying to eke out an existence in primitive situation. Still, there's a great deal of work to do, and it's good to know that there is help, and I do have guidance. And there's spirit behind it all.
Yeah. Of course, my experience that which awakened me and made me aware that I really did have a mission, that I had something to do in this life, was when I was 13 and my kidneys had failed, and I died for about 2 minutes. I was my heart wasn't beating, and during that time I was told that I had a couple of missions in life, and when I came back, I came back of my own choice, and I wanted to do those two missions more than anything in this world. I didn't know what they were, but it was incredibly powerful to me, and I never, ever swayed away from that realization. I definitely was helped by that. And then when many things had happened to me, and I had seemingly lost a great deal in terms of turning down fame and fortune in other things, and when I was first with Don Elkins, I had a dream that was a very clear dream. And at the end of it, Don and I were sailing down a canal that led out onto the sea. And I was looking back at my house on the shore that was burning down. And the voice said, "You will never be able to go back again." So I knew it was a choice between sailing into unknown waters with Don or going back into that burning house. And, of course, I chose the unknown waters with Don. So, you know, twice in my life I've had a dream or an experience that put me on the road. When I had finished with the Law of One contact because Don died, I realized in retrospect that that had been my first mission. And so I wondered, well, what's my second mission? Because I'd been told I had two things to do. And then I thought of what Don had asked me to do. He had asked me two things. One, to head a spiritual community, and two, to make the material that we were gathering available worldwide, globally. Now, at the time that he said that, in the 70s, computers were not widely available. And I had no idea how I was going to accomplish that. But by the time he died in 1984, it became very clear as to how I was going to do that. And out of nowhere came a wonderful man who lived in Toronto. His name's Ian. And he asked me if he could create a website to hold my messages, because he had found them very meaningful. And there it was. You know, my second job opened up before me, and I was able to get the messages out globally to anybody that has computer access, and these days that's almost everybody, except in the depths of rural Africa, say, or rural anything. And I'm now living the Law of One. I think that's what Jim and I are attempting to do. So it's been so beautiful to realize, okay, I'm pretty settled now. I'm on my second mission, and I just need to stay on task. And what I'm saying is it's very important to listen to your dreams and things that happen to you that are unusual. And don't poo-poo them or say, well, that's just something, I don't know what. It's so easy to disregard things like that. But take hold of those things that come to you and listen to them and think about them, and in doing so something will open up before you, and you will know for sure that you are made of love, that you came to hold the light, and that you can do it. You're worthy of doing it, and you can do it. Doesn't matter what your station in life is, what your education is like, anything like that. Just do it. Good luck, everybody. Let's change the world. Let's make it a place where love reigns.
Sounds like a good idea to me. You know, you just mentioned some examples of guidance coming through in dreams and that sort of thing. Have either of you ever had what I call school dreams? That seems to be a recurring theme for me.
Well, yes. Back in, I guess, the 70s, I was in the class. Usually now I'm teaching the class, but, you know, the dreams are the same. I'm in the school, and a lot of the time the dream has to do with the fact that I don't know where my classroom is, and I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be teaching. You know, sort of scrambling around trying to get squared away. How about you, Monica? Have you had experiences like that that are meaningful?
Oh, yeah. This has been an ongoing theme in my dreams for, excuse me, for years. I mean, for the last, I don't know, decade, a couple of decades at least. And I always can tell when I'm doing something right, you know, based on those dreams. So I really pay attention when I have those. But what would happen is I would have this recurring dream where either I couldn't find my locker, or I could find my locker, but I didn't know the combination, or I couldn't find my class, or I made it to class, but I was late, and I didn't have my homework assignment, and I wasn't prepared for the test. And sometimes, oh gosh, I would go to class and then suddenly realize that I had been missing class for the past 2 months, and the semester was over, and it was time for finals. I mean, just these awful, you know, always the same idea where I was not prepared. And I would have the same recurring theme going on for, you know, I'd have the dream every so often, every few nights, or every week or two or whatever for like weeks. And then finally, I guess I'd finally figure it out or get it right. And then all of a sudden I'd have a dream where I aced the test, you know, or I was the teacher. I was the teacher, or maybe I had graduated and I was now in college, because usually the dreams were always high school. So then I think, all right, you know, and it always coincided with some time in my life where I had kind of made some kind of breakthrough. So it really made a lot of sense. And then maybe, I don't know, a few months later, you know, I wouldn't have a school dream for months and months. And then all of a sudden I'd have school dreams again. Same pattern. I was like, oh, no, what is it I'm not getting? I couldn't find my locker again. Oh, no. And then it would go on and on and on. And then finally I'd get it right. And then I'd have a dream where I was in college or I was the teacher again. So it always cycles around, you know, different layers of lessons I have to learn, I guess. So I was just wondering if other people had that.
I think the scariest thing that I ever dreamed was that I was not dressed. There I was, without clothing, and thinking to myself, how do I get out of this one? And I never did. You know, in the dream, it was just, it sort of fell apart, and I was left in that situation. But at any rate, the dreams, I think those dreams are important, you know. I think in my case, at least, I think it's valid that we are students in classes, and we're doing that while we sleep. And maybe at some point we get to the point where we can teach a class, and then we're teachers. Jim, have you ever had those dreams?
Every now and then I've had that kind of dream.
Yeah.
It seems to have been something that happened further in my past. I haven't had that kind of dream for years, though.
Well, I hope this talking hasn't brought it back to you. Unless they're good dreams.
Well, I think we've probably all had dreams where we were exposed or vulnerable somehow, you know, in some way. I tell you a dream that was really bugging me, because it seemed so ridiculous. For a while, I kept having these dreams about going to the bathroom. And I'm like, why did I dream that? And then just recently, somebody posted on the forum a thread called Poop Dreams. And I was like, you know, I never actually had a poop dream. It was the other type, okay? It was just having to go pee, you know? Sure. I mean, it was so funny. Yeah. And it was this discussion came up, and I forgot who started the thread, but it was very insightful that even something that seems so silly and so mundane, there was some significance that it had to do with letting go of, you know, waste or things that no longer serve us. And I thought, wow, that's insightful. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I guess all kinds of interesting themes. Well, I guess I'm going to go ahead and go to the the first question, I'm going to go to Yossarian's question, and that has been on hold for a bit. Now, this wasn't actually asked on the forum. It's just something I got off a thread from a while back that I thought would be some good, interesting discussion. And Yossarian asks, what is the difference between turning the other cheek and being a slave? In addition, what's the difference between total service to others and being a slave? Does the Law of One see Christianity as promoting a slave morality? Does the Law of One endorse that slave morality? Where does mysticism, religion, and spirituality used to control and pacify separate from mysticism, religion, and spirituality that is beneficial for the follower? And why does it seem like when a teaching leads to material prosperity, it's often considered immoral?
Well, in the first place, I'll take that last part because I think that considering the material prosperity immoral is more the property of the church proper than us on our spiritual paths. I don't think that there's a universal feeling that if you have something, then you should be ashamed. But I do see that in the fundamentalist churches, especially. The difference between turning the other cheek and being a slave is your intention. When you turn the other cheek and you turn the other cheek and you come to the end of what you can personally handle, then it's time to draw a boundary. And slaves can't draw boundaries because they're already bound. The difference between total service to others and being a slave is that it's our choice. And I think that from Ra in session 83, there is a little bit here that sort of sheds light on this, and I'm just going to read it out to you and then comment on it. It's question 12 and 13, and Don asks, then you say that there are no cases where those who are of a service to others orientation are using techniques of enslavement that have grown as a result of the evolution of our social structure. Is that what you mean? And Ra answers, it was our understanding that your query concerned conditions before the veiling. There was no unconscious slavery, as you call this condition, at that period. At the present space-time, the conditions of well-meant and unintentional slavery are so numerous that it beggars our ability to enumerate them. Don says, then for a service to others-oriented entity at this time, meditation upon the nature of these little expected forms of slavery might be productive in polarization, I would think. Am I correct? And Ross says, you are quite correct. That conversation goes on for a while, so I didn't get all of it. But it ends up with Ra suggesting that the biggest point of unintentional and well-meant slavery is marriage, where one person is taking hold of the other as if the other were a slave and were bound to fulfill his needs or her needs. Usually in our societies, since cliches like it's a man's world float around all the time, where there's smoke, there's fire, it is a man's world. Even in enlightened America or enlightened Europe, you have, for the most part, an expectation that the man is Mr. Wonderful and the woman is the little woman and is... You know, my father, for instance, firmly felt that it was his duty to make the money for the family, and he wanted the mother at home to raising the children, doing good, and attending church. Kuchen, Kirchen, und Kinder. Yeah, that's it. Children, kitchen, and church. And mother was not at all a housewife by temperament or nature. And she was an angry, angry woman until I remember when I was 10 years old and she finally got a job and started going to school again. And I breathed such a sigh of relief because it's so nice to have a happy mom. And it really made her happy to do that. And she ended up being a licensed psychologist and doing everything from teaching as a professor to, I think, at the end of her career, she spent, I think, 15 years at a mental hospital, and she did all the testing for the hospital and all of the witnessing to the judge when there was a trial as to whether a certain person that was arraigned was able to stand trial, knew what being guilty meant, understood what that was. And so she did a beautiful late career, you know, starting when she was 30, going back to school. So I think that, and then of course, if you look at the Asian view and the Middle Eastern view, you see people hiding their women in harems and covering them so that no one can look at them, and just almost obliterating women. It's as though they were afraid of them. But it, according to their thoughts, it's because women are so weak that if they didn't take care of them like that, then women would all become harlots, which is laughable because most of us, I really just want to be left alone to do our thing, you know, not too interested in being constantly on call for sex. So, I mean, not speaking for everybody, but certainly for myself. I believe that your intention makes all the difference. If you know what you're doing and you say, okay, this and this and this, I will accept because that is fulfilling the needs of my mate. And this other, I won't accept because it is not fulfilling my needs and is toxic. And then you draw that boundary and you stick to it. I think it's really important to use your power well. And sometimes when you use your power well, what you're doing with it is you are retreating from clobbering somebody else over the head and getting your way. And you are trying to support that person as that person is growing. I know with my, what I call my starter husband, and that's a long story, he wouldn't work. He wouldn't go to school, and he was one class away from finishing a 5-year course in engineering. Wouldn't go back and get that one course. And, you know, yet I didn't try to make him do these things because I could see how miserable he was. I really didn't want to add to the misery. So I just let him be, and I went on with my life. And people thought I was crazy to put up with that. But I felt that it was the best thing that I could do for him, and I had long ago drawn the boundary, and I did not anymore take any of this personally. I thought it was his problem, not mine. And after 4 years, he did too, and owned up to the fact that he didn't want to be married at all. And I was very grateful to him when he asked me for a divorce, because it was a great relief not to be in that situation anymore. But having drawn the boundary and getting on with my life, I was not suffering from this. I was simply living my life and having a good time being a librarian and going to church. I'm a real church. What do you call a person that loves to go to the library, a book rat or something like that? Anyway, I was definitely a church mouse, And well, it got to the church pretty much every time the doors were open. I'm still like that. I love to go to church. I love to be there. It feels really good to me. But had I felt, you know, squashed by this man, it would have been an entirely different thing. I think it's all internal to you. It's very subjective whether you are a slave or whether you are doing something because you feel it's the best thing to do. I also, you know, was able simply to pick up and go on. The divorce didn't bother me in the slightest. I was greatly relieved, and it felt so good when, you know, it stopped and I could move on with my life. But it didn't throw me at all. I greatly enjoyed life in a continuum and kept on going and let life change me as it would. So using myself as an example, I can honestly say that I never felt that I was in the position of a slave, although that's kind of what it looked like from the outside. I was simply doing my best to encourage and support my husband and let him figure out what it is he wanted to do. And he finally figured out that what he wanted to do was leave me, because I had taken somehow he sort of thought of me as his mom, and he hated his mom. You know, it was not a good basis for marriage. So it was wonderful when it stopped. But I didn't want to go back on my promise, and that was as simple as that. You know, I'd made promises, and I was going to keep those promises, and I did enjoy. I had a good feeling about my decision. When you are joyful about what you were doing, when you are in control of what you are doing, it doesn't matter if the world thinks you're a doormat. You're not a doormat. When you decide, well, no, this isn't working for me, I think I want to move on, then you simply do. Or you draw a boundary and say, you know, this much and no more. And drawing boundaries is very important to set intentions so that personal relationships do not become toxic. Anybody have anything to add to that? Monica, Jim?
Well, what I'm hearing you say, and I think this is very, very insightful, is that it's not based on how much you do for the other person. It doesn't matter what it looks like to other people. What matters is that it's your choice, because a person could choose to be totally loving and giving to their mate and yet still be in control of their own choice. And it might look like they're just giving, but if it's their choice, then that's okay. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, if it doesn't exhaust you, if it's not toxic. I think you have to move out of toxic situations, and that the way you do that is completely up to you. But take responsibility for a toxic situation. Recognize a toxic situation. Recognize the implicit slavery in some relationships, and don't accept that. Draw your boundary and move on. And if it means that you have to leave a relationship, well, that's the way it falls out. Jim, you have any insights?
Yeah, that's it. It's free will that's a paramount point here. A slave isn't able to exercise free will and has to do what is directed. Mm-hmm. But a person who wishes to be of service and does so out of a free will choice is no slave, is guiding his or her own actions by the choice being made.
Yeah.
So by toxic situation, would you say the definition of a toxic situation is when one person is controlling the other against their will?
Yes.
Okay, so that's what makes it toxic.
One person controlling another, period. I mean, one person should not be controlling another person. It may look like that from the outside, say, and not really be true. But if it is true, then the energy needs to be moved to a different way.
So a relationship could be one that has a lot of bumps in the road, a lot of conflicts even, but if both people are willingly engaged and willingly working out these life lessons and dealing with these catalysts and they're progressing, then even though it may look like a very rocky relationship, you wouldn't call that toxic. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that I don't think we need to be afraid of difficult situations. We just need to make sure that our free will is not being infringed upon.
Okay, excellent. Well, that leads right into the next question, which is from Plenum. Again, one that was posted on the forum a while back. And Plenum asks, what are the boundaries of free will?
Well, free will certainly does have boundaries. And the Ra group was very careful to explain them at different points in the conversation that he had with Don in those 106 sessions. And by the way, the reason that I respond using the Law of One is that this is a Law of One call. If I were in a different arena, say I was talking to a Christian audience, I would use quotes from the Bible and talk, you know, from that point of view that I see the Bible offering. I have my own opinions, and they do find a way to come out using the Law of One as an authority. That's why you keep hearing me quote from various entities in the Confederation. And in this case, I picked session 73, question 14. To shed light on the boundaries of free will. Don asked, an observation of the working itself by another entity would seem to me to partially abridge free will, in that a seemingly magical occurrence had taken place as a result of the working of an adept. This could be extended to any phenomenon which is other than normal or acceptable. Could you speak on this paradox that is immediately the problem of anyone doing healing? Ra says, we are humble messengers of the Law of One. To us, there are no paradoxes. The workings which seem magical and therefore seem to infringe upon free will do not in themselves do so, for the distortions of perception are as many as the witnesses, and each witness sees what it desires to see. Infringement upon free will occurs in this circumstance only if the entity doing the working ascribes the authorship of this event to itself, or its own skills. Those who state that no working comes from it, but only through it, are not infringing upon free will. And I think that makes it pretty clear. This is in the context of healing, but you can look at it in the context of just about anything. I'm fond of saying that your free will ends at the end of your nose. You have the free will over your own decisions. You have the free will over what you're going to manifest. You have free will according to your own thinking. But so does the other person in a relationship. So does the other person in an acquaintance. And the most common thing that people do that are excited about the Law of One is to try to tell everybody about it. It seems just like the thing to do. You know, I'm so excited. This, you know, has changed my life. These readings have changed my life, and I want to share this. And then they become very frustrated because nobody's listening. And you see, that's because their free will is being infringed upon. They haven't asked you for any information. You have to wait patiently until someone asks you about some spiritual principle that's covered by the Law of One, which is just about everything in the whole range of philosophy and cosmology especially. When they ask, then fire away, you know. Express yourself and talk about the Law of One and what it has meant to you and how it has worked for you. That's great. But if if nobody is asking you, you can listen to the flow of conversation. And if you spot a likely moment, you can insert into the conversation a thought that has to do with the law of one. And then you move on. You don't look back. You're like Johnny Appleseed. You're not attached to the outcome of this. You just toss that eaten apple over your shoulder and keep walking. You don't go back to see if it sprouted. You don't go back, you know, to see if it took. You just move on. So the boundaries of free will have to do with the limits of what the other person is. So when you bump up against another person, you have to remember that you're bumping up against the Creator and have the ultimate respect for the soul within that person. Sometimes the soul within a person is really hard to see, but it's there. And you can only assume it's there by faith. And if you find yourself trying to change that person for their own good, then you know for sure that you're starting to infringe on free will. It's like working in a soup kitchen. You fix the soup and you serve it to the people that want it. The people that don't want it, even if you think they're hungry and should be eating, they just don't want it. Thank you very much. And, you know, far more sophisticated things than that are usually the issue. But it's always possible to find a creative way to serve. For instance, I have a friend who works for a nonprofit agency in the poor part of town. Of course, you know, the government doesn't give a lot of money to nonprofits who are just trying to do something like help abused women get a new lease on life. So the headquarters is in what Don Elkins would have called the combat zone in Louisville, and there always is one in any urban area. So frequently when he walks from his work to his car, he is accosted by a person who asks him for money. Well, my friend does not want to give that person money because he knows the person will just go out and buy more booze or whatever he's getting high on. So he says, I won't give you money, but I'll take you to, and he mentions the nearest fast food restaurant, which happens to be McDonald's, and, you know, I'll give you a Mickey D food. And so every once in a while, somebody takes him up on it and is grateful for the meal. Otherwise, he's drawn that boundary and decided how he wants to respond, and he doesn't want to enable this person in his addiction. And so that's his choice, and it's a good example of what the boundaries of free will are, I think.
Okay. Thank you. Anything to add, Jim, to that?
Oh, no. I think Carla said it well. Free will is, I think, the quality that we've come here to exercise most importantly in order to choose our own directions. And there's so many ways to get ourselves entangled in situations where we're unable to use our free will, or at least it seems that we're unable to use it. And in some cases, I think we tend to make ourselves slaves or subservient to another person because we're unaware of needs we have on our own to choose our own path. So I think free will is something that we need to be aware of at all times, not just for ourselves, but for others as well, to be able to allow other people to be as they wish to be and not to try to put our ideas of how they should be upon them. I hope that made sense. We'll take a vote here later.
Oh, yeah, that made sense. Absolutely. Well, we have, I think, just enough time left for one more question. So I'm going to go to one of Siren's backlog of questions that we have saved for a rainy day. And by the way, I'd like to let everybody know that we do enjoy having live callers, and you can ask a question live on the air. You can just call 646-595-2294, 646-595-2294, and press the 1 key if you'd like to ask a question live on the air. So this question is, what do you think imagination and visualization are? How do these relate to thought and light and illusion? Is this not the one infinite dreaming itself?
Okay, let me get my thoughts on that up. I did some research on that, and I want to use a quote. Here we go. For one thing, first, I looked up imagination, and it's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. The dictionary says it's the faculty of forming mental images or concepts of what is not actually present to the senses, or the action or process of forming such images or concepts, or the faculty of producing ideal creations consistent with reality, as in literature, as distinct from the power of creating illustrative or decorative imagery. So that's straightforward, and it's right there in the word, imagination, imaging. I think imagination is really important. The more we can imagine, the more we can create, the more we can spin out our fairy tales, dark and light, the better off we are, because the more expansive is the span of our thinking. Ra says, Don asks in session 93, question 10, and he's looking at one of the cards in the tarot deck that form the archetypal mind of the Egyptian way. And he's looking at the bird in that card. And he's saying, well, the bird, I'm guessing, might be a messenger of the two paths depicted by the position of the wings, bringing catalyst at which could be used to polarize on either path. Is this in any way correct? And Ross says, all uses of catalyst by the mind are those consciously applied to catalyst without conscious intent. The use of catalyst is never processed through mentation, ideation, and imagination. And so there comes intent again. When one is looking at catalyst, and if one can, the proverbial count to 10, if one can create the spaciousness around a situation to give oneself time to choose how to respond, the great thing there is to be creative. If you take the straight path, usually it's not serving you or the other person. It's a knee-jerk reaction. It's something that your mother said or your teacher said, or you get so bound up in the voices in your head that aren't you, that it's hard to break through that and find yourself and what you really think and how you really want to act. But if you can manage to pull back from being emotional, having emotional reactions long enough to look at the perception that you're having and sort of explore it briefly, then I think that, as Ross said, mentation, ideation, and imagination can be called up. Mentation simply means that you're analyzing the thing, you're using your mind. Ideation means that you're assigning to the things that you are seeing certain ideas that are there in philosophy or literature, and you are, you know, organizing things differently according to the way you see them. And lastly, imagination. Of course, you are looking at something as a person that is an artist, that is going to create an image. And you look at that with imagination, and you paint or draw or compose a melody of the response that you feel will both tell the truth and be kind. That is the challenge, I think, of all of us, is to find a way to tell the truth without being cruel. I think it's possible. I've had great success with that. And people will sometimes say to me, you know, well, my mother said to me once, Carla, she said, you're like a surgeon. You cut to the bone, and I don't even know that it's hurting. You're just so precise, you know. And I thought that was one of the most beautiful compliments I ever got, because I do try to do that. I do try, you know, to find ways, to create ways in which I can both tell the truth and have compassion. And I think that's the trick of imagination. Now, visualization is simply the ability to hold something in your mind, a rose, the magical shapes of sacred geometry, and so forth. This goes far into the archetypal mind. When you're working with visualizations, you are moving yourself into the archetypal mind that you have. You're moving into the roots of consciousness. And it's very powerful work. And I encourage everyone to do it, but at the same time, I encourage you to do it, if possible, in a group or at least with another person. And if possible, with somebody that knows more about it than you do, so that you have somebody to ask when you have a question. But these are ways of playing or dancing with the light that you were given. I like what you said. How do these relate to thought and light and illusion? It is an illusion. We are all thoughts dancing. And we dance. Jim, what's that quote from session one? We're thoughts dancing.
Good question. We're thoughts dancing in a ballroom of thought.
Yeah, we're dancing with each other and creating according to our distortions. And we all have distortions. So I think imagination and visualization have everything to do with thought and light and illusion. The thought, we are all thoughts. Light is what thought or love uses to manifest love. So, illusion, yes, this is an illusion. And we will never be in anything but an illusion until finally, in many densities from now, we release all things and just abandon ourselves to move back into the Creator. We wouldn't know how to do that now. We don't have our full personality. We don't have our whole soul stream. There's much that is ahead of us. So it's no good to try to do that now, because we'd only be trying with a part of ourselves, our great larger self that is found in between incarnations. And so thank you for the insightful question, Siren. As a matter of fact, I have enjoyed that series of questions so much in the process of wending my way through those questions. More than just about anything I've done for a while. it's just so much fun to work with somebody who's really in their thinking, and certainly you are, Siren. I appreciate that very, very much, and I just can't tell you how much fun I've had sharing your space and sharing your curious and powerful imagination.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because we actually have several more from Siren that are still on that
yes,
list.
Yes, we do.
And actually, some of them are pertaining to thought. So that'll be a nice continuation for next week to expound upon what you just said about thought. And we are just about out of time. Did you have any last very quick comments? We have about 2 minutes left.
No, I really don't. Let's see. Let me take that question that is, what is darkness and what is light? And I'll just start it, and we can go ahead with it next week. In the first place, I believe that darkness, there is a darkness and there is a light. And I refer to chapter 1 of the book of John, the Gospel of John, in which he talks about, let's see, where is my, I don't have it right in front of me now, but at any rate, it talks about the light coming into the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Now, if darkness and light were the same thing or opposites of the same quality, there would not be that distinctness, that separation. So I'd like to go into that first next week and really get into that that question about light and dark, because when the Ra group or the Quo group or any of the Confederation entities greet us or say goodbye to us, they say, we leave you or we greet you in the love and the light of the one infinite creator. They are saying all that there is, because all of us are love, and love uses light to manifest. Comments from you, Jim, Monica?
Well, I'm looking forward to the conversation next week. That's a good place to start.
Okay. Yeah, same here, same here. Okay, and just one quick comment I wanted to share from Patrick on the Bring Forth Forum. Patrick says, I am doing Reiki for you, Carla, and I hope it will help you.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. I am absolutely grateful for all of that. You know, I've had so much absent healing, and so many people have worked on me with Reiki masters have worked on me over time. And, of course, it doesn't matter how far away you are. That energy knows no bounds of space. It's just there. So I am open to it, and I welcome it consciously every day and ask for it and give thanks for it. And I honestly believe that I would have had a much different experience in these 2 years of difficulty that I've had just continually. But I have never become despondent or gotten into any kind of depression. I have felt lifted up, and it's just wonderful. And I think that all of those who are helping me that way can really give themselves a pat on the back and know that you really are creating a big difference in my life. And I just really, really thank you for that. I thank everybody for whatever has been, whether it's cards or presents or flowers or food. there's been so much of an outpouring over these 2 years, and it's just absolutely beautiful. I know at one point I had so many cards up that we had to take them down because we didn't have any room for any more cards in the whole house. Every door was decorated.
Wow.
part. So that's pretty incredible.
We love you, Carla.
I love everybody.
Yeah. Okay. We are totally out of time, and I'm probably going to get cut off here, but I'm going to go ahead and read our quick little info here. You have been listening to LL Research's In the Now with Carla L. Record and Jim McCarty. Please visit the website llresearch.org, which has our Law of One transcript and lots of other good stuff, and bringforth.org, that's bring the number 4th.org, which is the community website, and you can post a question there at the miscellaneous section, or you can be here and post a question on the chat room or call us live. And we will be here next Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. That is June 8th. We are here every Friday. Have a great week.